Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Jude Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On this episode, we're going to talk about the Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio, in the aftermath of the presidential debate. We are going to look at some new research talking about the challenges and dangers of loving your job. And then we bring in Noah Hamm, who plays in our worship band and is a part of the BYA community, to talk about some of the challenges that young men are facing in this time. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hello again. Pastor Brian here with you, along with Pastor Judah.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, or whatever time it is
whenever
when you're listening.
You're listening,
to this.
We appreciate you. Pastor Judah, best thing you saw this week?
Yeah, so I'm going to cheat and do two. The first is, very selfishly, I went to a concert of the legendary Cynthia Erivo. For anybody who doesn't know who she is a famous Broadway actress and musician who really rose to prominence for playing Celia in The Color Purple on Broadway in the revival of that show. But you will probably most likely know her as the star of the upcoming Wicked movie coming out in November of 2022. Wicked is a very, very famous stage musical that's now being adapted for movie. I went and saw her live in premier orchestra seats. I felt very, very bougie and also, you know, very poor now. And she just was fantastic.
Where was the concert?
San Francisco.
Oh, man.
She was fantastic. She sang a lot of really old songs. I mean, she sang like some Nina Simone and she sang some stuff from Funny Girl. And but she was just fantastic. So that was really amazing. And then the other thing that I saw that was just excellent this week is we dedicated somewhere around 60 babies.
A bunch of babies.
Yesterday. And many of them are children of, you know, young adults in this church, of younger families, of folks who maybe struggled with pregnancy, of folks that we like married. Like, so this particular baby dedication felt like very full circle. And just seeing, you know, our own Pastor Cliff just had his baby dedicated. Our own Maddie, who runs the cafe, she just had her baby dedicated. And it's just really kind of special when the community comes together around the babies, because it's the one thing that, like, we all agree on, right? It's like, kids matter, and we need to love on them, and they're special, and I just loved it.
Amen. That was great.
What about you?
So, yeah, I'll say, yeah, that as well. I love baby dedications, and it, yeah, it was super cool. Loved getting to kind of pray for those kiddos and bless those families. And then, you know, my other one, Pastor Judah, is just, it's the simple things in life.
It is the simple things.
I got to play pickleball this morning before I came into work.
I'm so sorry.
I don't get to play pickleball that often. There's only so many hours in the day, and I'm trying to get in shape for a, you know, race I'm hoping to do. So I've
what are you doing next?
I'm trying to do a Spartan race here in a little bit and a half marathon distance. And that just requires a ton of training. But here's the funny thing about pickleball. So my dad actually invited me to play, which was super cool. And I had not played, my parents live in Sun City, Lincoln, and I hadn't played there in a while. And it was so funny. I pull into the parking lot at 6:55. All the courts are empty because you're not allowed to play until 7. But it was like a whole crew of people showing up for work, because it was just this like stream of cars into the parking lot. And by like 7:02, they have 12 courts. All 12 courts are full.
What is the demographic of the people who are playing with you? Like, are they all around your age?
No. This is Sun City. So everyone's 55 plus.
Okay.
So everyone, but that's the beauty of pickleball, is that athleticism helps, but it does not help nearly as much as it does in, say, basketball. So we're able to have competitive games, and I'm also not that good, so with people older than me. So that was really fun. But all right, moving on to something that is a little bit less fun.
Yeah.
And that is the story of what is happening in Springfield, Ohio, which is really, I know, pretty deeply troubling to both of us.
And
Pastor Judah, we'll hear your thoughts on it initially, just as I set it up. For those who may have missed it, there have been these false rumors going around that the Haitian community in Springfield is eating people's pets and engaging in all sorts of other kind of odd behavior. And these false rumors that are getting amplified by politicians and online communities and things like that are creating real harm for the Haitian community in Springfield.
Yeah, that's right.
And also are causing kind of those in the area to kind of overlook the legitimate challenge of this is a small, predominantly white town that is having to navigate kind of the cross-cultural element of having a huge influx of folks from another culture,
yeah,
in this case,
right.
folks from Haiti, coming in. And it's anyway, what are some of the problems, or what is it about this story that is frustrating to you?
Yeah, I mean, the list is long. So chapter one, article A, section two. First and foremost, it's just not accurate, right? That there are people kind of moving in the political space who are kind of saying these things about these Haitian immigrants that are, as of now, unfounded, right? That there is not this widespread, you know, thing of Haitians eating cats and dogs. But also that it is specifically designed to other.
Yeah.
A lot of these people who are being described are there legally, in the country legally.
Pretty much all of them, from what I've read.
The vast majority, for sure. That a lot of them came because Springfield, Ohio, was saying, hey, our population has gone down. There are all these jobs that are not filled. Come here, we have jobs. And then these people show up and they're having, all of these issues. And that the people who are loudest about this conversation are the people with no skin in the game.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not really the people, even, you know, the folks in Springfield who may actually, like, be dealing with some real adjustment challenges of, like, you know, you take 20,000 of anybody and put them someplace that they're not from, there are going to be some issues. But I think fundamentally the fact that it's not true and that it's designed to other in a way that dehumanizes.
For those who aren't familiar with the term, can you kind of give us a just sort of general definition? What does it mean to other somebody?
Yeah, it means to, you know, purposefully or sometimes accidentally kind of paint them in a way that completely disconnects them from you.
Yeah.
That sees them as something different. And when you use this kind of dehumanizing language, right, where you talk about somebody eating a cat or a dog, what does that imply? What it implies that that they're not civilized, that they're not they don't share your level of humanity. And when something is not human, we can do all kinds of things to it, right? Yeah. Because it's not human. So I think that that's a major issue. And so now, if you've been following the story, these Haitian immigrants are being targeted, are not going to school because they don't feel safe. It's really creating issues. And again, the conversation is being had very loudly by people who aren't going to be affected.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, and this is why, I mean, there's so many elements of this that are just disgusting.
Yeah,
to me,
it's rough.
That you say they have no skin in the game, and in the literal sense of they're not impacted by life on the ground in Springfield, Ohio.
Right.
That is absolutely correct. But in another sense, they do have skin in the game.
I hear you.
The purpose of this is not to help people. It's not to tell the truth. It's to rile people up for political benefit. Say what you want about J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance is not an idiot. He knows exactly what he is doing.
Mm.
And I don't care if he's Republican, Democrat, Independent, Socialist, Libertarian. I don't care. So I feel like I have to preface this every time I make a statement about a political figure. It is not about the man's party. He is lying, and he knows it, and he is incentivized to lie because it riles people up. It gets them upset. And even you look at some of the language that he's using around this. Oh, well, these terms may prove to be false, but, you know, spare me your outrage, and then kind of pivoting to criticize Kamala Harris on things, which, fine, you want to criticize Kamala, it's politics, go ahead, do it. But you've got the Republican mayor, you've got the Republican governor of Ohio going, this is not happening.
That's right.
And the problem is, there is no incentive for J.D. Vance, Donald Trump, or anybody else to just tell the truth, that they know there is a 0% chance they actually believe this is going on.
Mm.
There is no incentive for them to say, you know what, we spread this information, it's not true, and even go, let's talk about the legitimate challenge of places that have an influx of folks from other parts of the world, and just go, okay, that does create legitimate resource challenge.
Yeah.
There's no incentive for them to do that, so they're not going to do it.
Well, and you know, what I was thinking a lot about as we were kind of researching this story is, you know, my heart really breaks for the Haitians because just historically, Haitians have never ever been safe in the world, right?
Totally.
Like, you know, they're kind of like this first black free republic. And like from the beginning, they're getting hammered. And then the amount of natural disasters and poverty and challenges in Haiti. And so you say, you think about if I'm a Haitian immigrant in a place that has just been just hit by issue after issue, and I say, okay, there's this land of opportunity that has invited me, that says, hey, we have these kinds of manufacturing jobs here. Come here, and I do the paperwork, and I do the interview, and I pass the test,
and
I
leave
pay
your,
all the money.
Leave your home.
And I leave my community, and I come, and I just am trying to figure out, you know, what does it look like to build this life? I watched some interviews of folks there, and every Haitian that was interviewed by the journalist, when they said, why did you come? They said, to work.
Yep.
To work. And to get here and be dealing with this, and not, again, not because the people of Springfield who already live there are, you know, trying to figure out how do we balance this out and make sure that this place is okay for everybody. But really because there are political forces in the world that see this as beneficial to their, you know, their political aspirations and aims, again, at the expense of, like, real lives.
Yeah, there's real harm going on here.
That's,
I mean,
right.
Even you look at the dad of the 11-year-old young man who was killed by a Haitian immigrant. He's had to come out and say, stop using my son as a political prop to kind of make your points. Here we've got, even on the, you know, on the flip side of things there, you've got a grieving family that now they see political forces trying to use their child to score points. And it's just, I don't know. The whole thing is just, I don't know. It's deeply troubling. But if there's one glimmer of hope, Pastor Judah, in all of this, to read from an article that was from the, or that was, I saw it on MSN.com, but it's from the USA Today, I believe. For many Haitian immigrants, Sunday mornings in Springfield, Ohio, are spent joyfully worshiping God as they sing and pray in their native Creole. This Sunday, they needed that uplifting balm more than ever. Their community is reeling, confused, frustrated, hurt from false accusations that they're eating their neighbors' cats and dogs. And it talked about how they're now dealing with violent threats. Their community has been upended. And praise the Lord for Reverend Carl Ruby, a gentleman who I know nothing about aside from this quote. He said, Jesus is with us in truth. And the truth is that Haitians are not eating pets and geese in Springfield. And at their church, he invited community members to join his congregation in prayer and peaceful protest of the false rumors leveled against their Haitian neighbors. That sounds like prophetic witness right there.
It makes
churches tell the truth and don't get sucked into all of this kind of falseness. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, I think, first of all, I mean, our Savior was an immigrant, you know, when things were politically chaotic in his own country and, like, you know, there was a dictator who was trying to kill him, you know, he went and hid in another country. So, yeah, I think we should be praying about this. But I think the bigger thing is I just want to be really careful always about what stories we tell and spread, right? And how easily, and this isn't just something that conservatives struggle with. In this particular case, it's the Republicans, but I think, you know, Democrats have struggled with this too. Just that we got to be really careful about kind of what we believe about people, where that information is coming from, and being really, really careful, I think, to not paint with broad brush strokes, right? Because, like, you know, there is some real strain on the system when you have an influx of people. But it's not this that we're talking about. So we're praying for our Haitian brothers and sisters. We're praying for the folks down there in Springfield, Ohio. Listen, Springfield, y'all can work this out. Don't embarrass us. Prove the worst of us wrong.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yep. Amen. We'll be right back.
So research shows that 20% of us like really love our jobs, which is like a lower number than I'd like, and would totally encourage everybody to like be working toward doing stuff that you love. And you think that's kind of the win, right? Like, if I'm doing my dream, if I'm doing what I love, that's the win. But there are some real downsides, some real risks to that. And we were reading a little bit about that. Pastor Brian, what are some of the risks that you have kind of discovered that can come along with like loving your work?
Yeah, there are. I mean, to love your work is a tremendous blessing.
Yeah,
I would certainly consider myself in that 20%, and I do not take that for granted for a minute. That generally speaking, coming to work is not a drag. Like I enjoy what I do. I like the people that I work with and feel like we're doing meaningful work, which is great. But I do think that there are a few things that we need to watch out for. One is just that sense of drift that I think can often happen where, especially just talking for us, but this is true of a lot of professions, that line between when am I working and when am I not can be very fuzzy sometimes. And it's easy to kind of let work invade home, invade other things. Oh, I'm watching the practice, but I'll answer a quick thing. You know, we can do all that. So there's that element of it. There's also, and research talks about this, and we'll link to some of this in the show notes. There is that sense of when we're passionate and when we're good at what we do, we tend to take on too much, which something that I try to keep as a guiding principle in my own life is when I'm making decisions about what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do, is I have to decide who am I going to disappoint in this moment.
That's good.
Right? So even something very simple. I'm in the middle of a conversation with my son, one of my sons, at church, and somebody comes up and they want to interrupt me. Who am I going to disappoint in that moment?
I hope the person who interrupted you.
Exactly. And that's the goal, right? Is to go, somebody is going to be disappointed in me right now. Who's it going to be? And if I say yes to every, you know, different thing that comes up, okay, who am I disappointing? Because, and this is, I mean, maybe a little bit of a cynical way to look at it, but I don't think it has to be. If we're not choosing our priorities in that regard, what happens is we end up disappointing the most important people who tend to not really kind of raise their hand and be like, hey, need a little attention and some, you know, some quality time over here until it's gotten really bad.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, one of the things I was really struck by and some of the things that we were reading was this risk that companies have when the work is meaningful to exploit their employees accidentally or unintentionally, right? And so I was thinking about, like, you know, where does that exist as, you know, as sometimes somebody who sometimes manages people, just wanting to be really, really careful about that. And then I think in terms of the blurring of the line and boundaries, for me, what I've noticed is that it's very incremental, that, you know, you say, okay, this is my work week. And then you say, oh, well, I'll just take one little meeting in the morning and this is why I have to do it. Or I'll just do this little thing that's kind of a violation of the boundaries that I set. Especially because when you love your work, it doesn't always feel like work.
Yeah.
But I think we actually always have to see it as work.
Yeah.
Because our bodies, our brains, our energies, and our resources are limited.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's about being really aware of the ways that it can incrementally sneak up, because I would love to say, like, and I do say, I'm good with my boundaries and my no means no. And if I'm not working, I'm not working.
Yeah.
But then you look up and you're doing that. How are you kind of protecting yourself from, like, falling into those kind of pit holes of, you know, I'm doing the work that I love and I'm doing too much of it, not taking good care of myself?
I'm not doing great at it, to be honest with you.
So I don't
know that I'm the best spokesperson for this.
Seven days and no day off.
What I've learned is, and this is, I think everyone's job is different and you sort of have to approach it in a way that is somewhat unique to your field. But I would, you know, I don't feel bad about maybe prescribing this for folks who it's a little more realistic, is just to know, okay, in my work, there are some days where it's just going to be 7 days, and that's just how it's going to be. And that doesn't mean I'm working, you know, 10 to 12 hours every one of those 7 days. I mean, I'll, you know, sneak in a half day here or, you know, kind of pick my spots to go, okay, I'm going to disengage from work now so we can have some quality family time or whatever. But just to go, okay, there are going to be weeks that are very intense. And also, I think when you do creative work, which in some realm, ours is creative work, you know this, you're a preacher, you're thinking about it even when you're not working.
Yeah, that's right.
So just your brain is always in the background going, okay, that next sermon I have to give, that next thing I have to lead, I'm thinking about it. But just to be able to go, okay, there are going to be really boom weeks.
Yeah.
And then there are weeks to go, okay, yes, there's always work to do, but you know what? I worked 60 or 70 hours last week. we're going to go 30, 35 this week and just give myself a little more space to go, okay, where can I maybe take a little bit of extra time off? I also encourage people, especially when they're really passionate about it, to figure out, okay, what does your job allow in terms of flexibility?
Yeah.
And also to kind of compensate for the challenges. So like, for example, one of the challenges of our work is I end up working a lot of nights and I work every weekend. Guess where I'm going to be between 10 and 11:30 this Wednesday morning? I will be going to the lunch on the lawn for the sixth graders and then the seventh graders at my kid's school. There is no chance my dad would have come to lunch on the lawn. He didn't have a job with that kind of flexibility. Now he was around more on the weekends. But just to be able to go, okay, I can arrange my schedule to step out and be there and kind of pick your spots in that regard. How about you?
I mean, I think a big part of this for believers is to remember that kind of at the core, what we're talking about when we talk about boundaries, when we talk about self-care, when we talk about not overworking, is really the rhythm that God designed for us. And the way he described it was Sabbath, right? Which is this idea that there's a time to work and then there is a time to not work, to rest, to delight in God. And so I think that when we are being intentional about this kind of in our workspace of like, okay, what are my parameters? What we're actually saying is, God, I believe you.
Yeah.
When you said this is how I was designed, I believed you. Yep. I believe that you are king and that you are the one who made me and shaped me and know what's best for me.
Yep.
And you know, I was talking to my BYA people about this last week. And one of the things that I was struck by is that Sabbath, like God had all the rules in the world, right? That he wanted for us as believers. And so he made his top 10 list, and like that makes the top 10. And not only, like the top 10, the top five.
Yeah.
It makes the top 10. It comes before don't steal, don't kill people, don't sleep with other people's spouses, right? Yeah. Like, so yeah. I think that a part of it is to look at how you're balancing your work life, you know, rhythm, to look at it as an act of honor to God.
Yeah.
Right? As an act of worship.
No, that's true. I think there's another side of this I want to hit is that even for those of us who are passionate about our jobs, there are times where work is just work.
Yeah.
And
that's okay.
And I do think that, I mean, I think you've heard me use this expression before, that I joke, you know, sometimes we're in the middle of something hard or whatever. There's a reason why we get paid to do this, right? Like, it's a job. And I think that whether you're in that 20% who loves their work or not, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that so much in our world is so convenient, right? I can get where I need to go, whether I drive myself or even those without, you know, a vehicle can, you know, call an Uber or things like that. I can, you know, generally have access to food and things to that effect. There's this ability to kind of customize so many things in our lives. We can go online and have something delivered. Heck, later that day, there is so
much
convenience. Yeah, right. And that what I think and a lot of that's great, don't get me wrong, but it can kind of cause us to get a little bit flabby in our ability to tolerate inconvenience. And there is a sense in which we have to recognize, like, if we're looking to work to be this like amazing, self-fulfilling, incredible experience all the time, that's probably the wrong place to look. And so that's my long-winded way of saying, I think that we need to recognize, okay, there are some things that we're good at that are productive, we can earn a living, serve society, glorify God, that aren't necessarily super fun all the time, but that, like, work is not meant to be entertainment. It's meant to be a manner of partnering with God and contributing to the world.
That's so good.
Even if like, I'm not having a great time doing it, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think remembering that the thing that you love is a job also allows you to have some of those harder conversations around, like, all things work. Those HR conversations, those conversations about compensation. I was just literally having to explain to somebody who wanted me to come to their church and preach for free that like, a part of the reason that I couldn't do it is because this is my job.
Yeah.
And so if I am over there preaching at your church for free, I am not at my church doing my job that my church
that you've been hired to
pays
do.
Me to do. Correct?
Yeah.
So I think, I think we got to have our boundaries. And I think actually what we need is some accountability in those spaces around that. Like, who is in your field that understands your field, that understands your love for your field, that can say, hey, Man of God, don't take no whole nother week and not take a day off. Yeah. I don't care what's going on.
Yeah.
Go home. Like, who can do that for you and kind of support you in that?
I was sitting with my dad at my son's baseball game the other night, and I was you know, semi-lamenting to him that, like, yeah, today is the first full day I've had off in a couple of weeks. And he goes, so if you were to hire someone else to do your job, because I've told them, like, I can't, like, blame this on anyone else. Like, I'm creating this, right? Mm. If you were to hire someone else to do your job, so would you tell them on weeks when they preach, they should just expect to, like, not take a day off and, like, work a ton of hours?
And die.
No. No, I wouldn't.
That's good.
So
that's,
I'm like,
good, Dad.
That's some wisdom right there. So I'm trying to, you know, reflect on that. So whether you're in that 20% or not, hope you're able to kind of keep working its right spot, and hope you're able to see, honestly, in the great stuff and in the not so great stuff, there's an opportunity to glorify God in your work and partner with Him in the work that He is doing.
That's right.
In the world. We'll be right back.
So we were doing some reading this week and started to learn about a lot of challenges that specifically Gen Z guys are facing, are walking through, and how they are, as a demographic, more likely to make not healthy decisions, that they are more likely to end up kind of in some unhealthy online spaces, that they are more susceptible to manipulation, to conspiracy theories, to violence, that they have, they're having higher rates of mental health issues and substance abuse than their female Gen Z counterparts. And I got really curious in that. Full disclosure, I have a vested interest via my job. And so in the studio today, I wanted to talk about that. And we've invited one of my students, Noah Hamm, to sit with us and just kind of have a conversation about what are we seeing from young men. So right now, young men are in what's called a precarious state for all the reasons I just listed. But I'm curious for you, Noah, and then you, Pastor Brian, what are some unique challenges that you feel like you or guys your age, specifically guys, what are you guys facing? What are you wrestling with?
I feel like guys my age are definitely facing, especially in a Christian sense, of finding my, like, calling as a child of God. That's a big one of, like, that's more of a personal internal struggle, not like from a society standpoint, but it's like a, what is my calling and how do I follow my calling? And I feel like another big one is like, what am I going to do with my life? Like, I'm at this weird, like, balancing point where I just graduated high school and I'm not going to college. So I'm like, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to get there? And like, how do I make it from a biblical standpoint, like a walk of life that is like edifying of God? Or like, and then another one is like, how am I going to provide for my future family? Like, God willing that I have a future family, but like, how am I going to live that out? Or like, finding where the Lord wants me in, like, ministry through worship and like evangelizing, or how to balance like work, family, life, and church. Like, all these new things that are coming into my life have been like really, it's been an interesting struggle and a challenge that I feel like everyone goes through is like, how do I balance this? So I feel like that's a big struggle.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're struggling with that just as a believer. What are you seeing from young men who may not necessarily be Christians? Mm. What kind of challenges are they facing that are kind of unique?
I feel like some of the same kind of things of like, what am I still going to do with my life? And how am I going to like raise a family? Or like, what are my goals? I feel like is a big one, because like, as a Christian, you see like, oh, my entire goal is to glorify God in my life. But if you're not Christian, that's not your goal. So like, what am I supposed to do? So I feel like that's something that I've seen, or like finding new hobbies and like what I want to do for work, I think is another big one.
I'm obviously no longer a young person, as much as I might like to think that
I think that's
not the case. But I think that young adulthood is a very exciting time, but it's also a little bit of a precarious time.
Yeah, that's
right. You don't have as many resources as maybe older adults do. There's not that level of clarity about kind of what you're doing with your life, as kind of Noah alluded to. And I think a real difference, I mean, I'm 42, and I think about what the world was like when I was 20, 21. And like at that point, I was going to school, I was in college, but still kind of asking a lot of those same questions. And we talked on last week's episode about the idea of the paradox of choice, right? Mm. That when you have a million choices, kind of nothing seems good enough. Mm. And I think that there's sort of a corollary to that that goes, okay, with social media, the internet, everything else, we have access to what everyone else is doing and everyone else's opinion. And I don't think this affects young men necessarily uniquely, but I think that young people, it does affect them maybe more than those of us who are a little more established in our lives, because we can feel, I think that, and Noah, I'd like to hear you speak to this, I think you can feel this sense of expectation because I see maybe all of these examples of the very small minority of young people who at least outwardly appear to have their lives figured out. Mm. And it makes you feel like, okay, I should have everything dialed in, when the truth is, at least in my opinion, the season of life of the year is like a time of exploration and a time of figuring things out.
No, I totally agree with that.
One of the things that we're learning is that there are a few reasons that young men right now are really having a hard time, right? And one of them is that all of kind of the major markers that they've been told about what it means to be a man, right? What it means to be a successful man, are changing and much more difficult to attain. So, for example, we kind of tell young men, hey, your job is to find a beautiful girl and marry her. Being a husband is going to be successful. Gross. But boys are having a harder time dating, right? We tell men that, you know, a part of the ways that they show up as men is to be able to provide, at least for themselves. Mm-hmm. Younger men are having a harder time finding a job. Mm-hmm. Younger men, Gen Z men are being vastly outran in terms of attaining education by their female counterparts, right? So there's this kind of economic erosion that's happening. There's also, I think, a changing of kind of traditional gender roles that young men are kind of trying to figure out what that looks like. So, you know, you've been told that, you know, you grow up and you're supposed to be the one that, you know, your lady depends on. But if she's got the degree, or if she's got the job, or if she makes money, all of these things, Gen Z women are more likely to get support for their mental health challenges than Gen Z men. As I was learning these things, I was wanting to be really careful to not put Gen Z in a box. And so what I want to know from you, Noah, is what do you feel like kind of the rest of the world misunderstands about guys your age?
Misunderstands. I feel like a lot of misunderstandings is that, like, we have to have it all figured out. Like, what you're alluding to is, like we're, like, right out of high school. It's like, bam, I know what I'm doing. Like, that's what high school, I feel like, wants you to do. Like, especially when I was in high school, it was like, oh, find your colleges. What's your profession? What do you want to do? What's your major? And it was just such a big, like, a pressure of like, oh, I have to have it all figured out. And I wanted to go into videography, and that didn't work out. But that wasn't a college profession, so, like, I never stressed about that. But I know so many of my friends and so many young men that were like, ooh, like, I have to go to college. I have to figure this all out. Like, right away. Like, they didn't, there wasn't any leniency of, like, I still have 4 years of college to figure it out. Like, it was more of, I had to figure it out right away. I have to have all these standards. And there was no buffer period or grace, I guess.
Yeah, so it sounds like you feel like that the rest of the world has expectations for young men that they are not, you know, kind of prepared to meet.
Yeah.
You know, I think that this really speaks to a lot of different issues, but certainly one of them is that idea of, okay, this pressure that I think a lot of us feel to, oh, I need to have everything figured out, which is just totally unrealistic.
Yeah.
And I think secondarily, that sense of, we can sort of feel this pressure culturally, even though we can't really name where it's coming from. Like, oh, I just feel all this pressure. Well, who's putting pressure on you? Well, the world, right? And I don't say that to, like, knock people that are feeling that, but I don't know. It's so odd to me how quick we are to feel this sense of, oh my gosh, I have to have everything figured out. I need to be, whether you're a young adult, I need to know my career. I need to know who I'm going to marry. Whether you're, you know, middle adult, oh, I have to be the perfect parent. I have to have the great job. And I think there are a lot of problems with that mentality. But one of them is I think that when we're held to unrealistic standards, we are prone to just sort of quit. And certainly my counsel to anybody in, you know, Noah, your season of life would be, okay, just keep moving forward. Whatever that looks like for you. Like, take small steps. You're 19, 20, 21 years old. Like, okay, don't just quit and do nothing. Don't like just take a job that'll, you know, meet your minimum needs and have no aspirations, but also like give yourself some grace to move forward incrementally. And I think that, again, in our world today where we have so much access to people, we can see finished products, and that kind of causes us to not recognize the value in the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and one thing that I think it plays a big role in all of this. So guys, Gen Z guys are facing more social isolation than any other demographic. And I think a few things happened, right? Is that this is the group who is, first of all, just terminally online, right? And have been for forever, right? But also, these people went through a pandemic during some of the most formative years of, you know, of your lives. And so you come out of that. And the reason I bring that up is because I was reading, and in the early 1900s, during the Industrial Revolution, you have actually the ways that we're talking about boys today and the challenges that they face. We find those same descriptors for Gen Z boys being talked about then too. And a part of it was because those boys had moved from like these rural kind of communities all of a sudden into cities and had no skill set for building relationships in the cities. And so you find that it's very similar that women are getting kind of better work, more support, that there's like all of this similarity. And what's interesting is that the country I was telling you earlier really responded to that, because at this time you have the creation of things like the Boy Scouts and other auxiliary guys organizations that combined fun, right? Because like the Boy Scouts was fun. I mean, I was never a scout because like outside ill, but I know scouts, and you know, you had fun, but you also had like kind of this character development. I'm curious, Noah, what you think would be helpful to guys your age from other folks. Like, what would support feel like in helping us kind of get through just this kind of rough period where, you know, like you said, you are trying to figure out life and figure out work and figure out love and make money and drink enough water and go to the gym and not become an alcoholic and eat your vegetables. And it's a lot, right?
It's a lot. The vegetables are the roughest part.
Well, you're talking, you know, Pastor Brian is a grassitarian.
But yeah, I'm curious to hear your perspective on that, Noah.
No, yeah, absolutely. I feel like the biggest thing for me that's helped me in this season of life is really good friends that can root you into the truth when you're spiraling of like, I don't know what to do. Yeah. And you have those people around you that can be like, okay, like here's the small steps you can take. And also having mentors like in your life that are obviously older and wiser than you that can guide you in a way and reassure you of like, everyone's gone through this stage to an extent. Like, here's what you can do. Here's what I did. And just like be there for you and just create fellowship. Like, I feel like fellowship is so underlooked, and I feel like has devolved since COVID because it's been all online and everyone has been isolating. And I mean, isolation just destroys like social aspects. Like it's just been an increase of social anxiety and it's just been really bad. But I feel like in general, good fellowship has really brought me, and I've seen it bring people way closer together and bring so much reassurance into this is what I can do. Like instead of going on your phone and just death scrolling on Instagram, like you can go out with your friends and like hang out at the mall or walk around or go on a walk. Like I feel like it makes you feel like you're doing things that are productive that can like bring you closer to your goals, but also guide you when you're doing your goals.
Yeah. Pastor Brian, what are you thinking?
I mean, everything you just described is getting off of our screens and looking at real people.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is, I'm not going to, you know, overstate it and call it like the cure for all of our problems. But, and I think for any age, that is so critical. And a important contrast, you know, Pastor Judah, you're talking about all these interventions we did, you know, 100 years ago. Were those important? Absolutely. I think I was not alive 100 years ago, but we also have to recognize, like, there was a lot less to compete with back
then,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Nobody is sitting at home on entertainment devices that can keep us kind of occupied for hours and hours and hours.
Or newspapers.
And yeah, right? Like, I mean, you read it and you're done, or you read a few paragraphs and you're done. So I think across society, kind of that it's a discipline, and I would say even a spiritual discipline, to go, okay, yeah, there's a space to be on devices, and certainly I spend more time than I would prefer on mine, but to go, relationships matter. You know, Noah, you said seeking out mentors matter. You know, being around other people. I mean, the pastor of the church I went to in college said, show me the books you read and the people you hang out with, and I'll tell you who you'll be in 10 years. And this is, of course, before smartphones, but I think there's such wisdom in that to go, am I hanging around people that are also trying to live productive lives, and so those types of things I think can be extremely helpful in I don't know, just keeping us out of some of these sinkholes that I think young men are particularly susceptible to, but other ages are as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I would just say, I think for kind of the rest of society in terms of supporting, one of the things that I was learning as I was reading kind of about this topic, it's actually very scary to read about, so I would not recommend it, but is that one of the things that is kind of pushing boys to these kind of really dangerous spaces and dangerous ideas is that boys don't feel like they can joke anymore. That, you know, where you used to be able to make certain kinds of jokes and that sort of thing, that now it can get you quote-unquote canceled. But also that sort of humor is not really appealing to most girls. So it's kind of getting in the way of dating. So one of the things that I was thinking about that we could do as a wider society to be helpful is just create spaces where, like, guys are able to kind of process a lot more of what they want to say in safe environments, right? So, again, I'm not advocating that we at all just, like, let racist jokes fly and things like that. But what I am saying is that if you were an older, specifically guy, and there's a younger guy in your life, give him a container to be able to speak freely without getting, you know, dragged by his ankles. Good. And then if you need to create some correction, then fine. But I think that, as silly as it sounds, I think actually boys need to be able to joke. And I think that they may even need to be taught, like, what does it look like to joke in healthy ways so that they can have that back?
Well, and I think so much of what is accessible online is so extreme and is training particularly young men in such, like, obviously wrong behavior.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's this, I've been doing a lot of reading about kind of grievance lately, and this sense of grievance that a lot of white men are expressing as we're having to deal with this radical idea of greater equality.
What?
And a lot, I know. And that there is this opportunity, and I use that word with air quotes in there, for kind of quote unquote aggrieved white men to, oh, we're not allowed to say anything anymore. Well, maybe you shouldn't be racist. Like, I don't have a ton of sympathy for it, but to be able to go, okay, let's actually process the changing world that we're in, and let's understand what does it look like to be a man who knows how to joke appropriately and knows why inappropriate jokes aren't. But I think, to your point, Judah, to do that in a constructive setting, shame does not work.
That's right.
And we need to be trained up in maturity and God-honoring language and even God-honoring humor, right? And those types of things.
Yeah. Well, praying for the boys. Praying for the boys.
We are back for a final segment. We're going to play a little game, and we've brought Noah back with us, and here's what's going to happen. Noah is going to give us a topic, and he has not given us the topics in advance, so neither Pastor Judah nor myself know what he is going to say, and then he's going to assign Pastor Judah and I a side, and we will each have 1 minute to debate our side of the topic that we are given. And we might have to defend a perspective we, in fact, do not hold.
I hope you get, like, why we should all be on the carnivore diet or
something. Why
like that.
We need to eat more meat.
I did consider that.
Okay. And we're going to have 1 minute each. We're going to do 2 of them, and we will see how it goes. So, Noah, would you give us our first topic, and who is taking what side?
All righty. First topic, our hot dog sandwiches. Or hot dogs are sandwiches. That's the first one. And then, Judah, you're going to be 4. and then Brian, you're going to be against.
Okay. Right. Do you want to go for it? All right. Hot dogs absolutely are sandwiches. What is the argument for a sandwich is that it's two pieces of bread and you put meat in between. Mm. Well, what is a hot dog? Two pieces of bread with meat in between. So it absolutely is a sandwich, and they're actually rather good sandwiches that I think, Pastor Brian, you should eat far more of in your life, particularly the 88-cent pack hot dogs from Walmart that are probably made out of, like, pig knuckles and pig elbows.
Boy, that's that does sound appetizing. That was a nice 30-second case you made. However, there's a key problem with your argument, and that is that a hot dog, in fact, does not involve two pieces of bread. What? It involves one piece of bread split in half. So if we're going to say the fundamental aspect of a sandwich is two pieces of bread, hot dog only has one. Also, a sandwich typically has a like flat slices of meat or some sort of kind of elongated piece of meat, whereas a hot dog is spherical in nature. Not really spherical,
elongated piece of meat.
Okay, you got me there, but hot dog looks very different from any other type of sandwich meat. If I were to put out 10 different types of sandwich meats in front of you, including like chicken breast,
there's allowed to be diversity in the sandwich world. All sandwiches don't need to look the same, Pastor Brian.
So I think we can all agree I won that one.
Noah, who won?
Just kidding.
Dude,
just kidding.
I feel like I got to go with Brian. Just
boom!
No, opinions aside. Opinions aside. They were both really good arguments.
One piece of meat. All right, next.
All right. I got some other really good options, and I'm trying to choose which one I want to do.
All right.
So I feel like I'm going to do, can we do two more?
We can try.
Okay. Two more. Let's
go. Okay. Hymns are better than modern worship music.
Who's doing what?
Judah, you're going to be doing hymns, and then modern worship music, you're going to be doing.
First of all, this is like in real life, my wheelhouse. Hymns are by far better than modern worship music. First of all, they were better written. They were written with so much thought and intentionality and good theology, right? Mm. They were biblical. You read you sing the hymns, you're singing the Bible. Bible. They also just had better, more diverse like chord progressions and like the musicality of them. Like all modern worship songs now are just like basically violent repetition.
Yeah, 1, 4, 5, 6 just the whole time.
Set us on fire. We wanna die for you.
I haven't heard that song.
I'm just saying, by far, hymns are better. I mean, let me explain something to you, Noah. When you would sing a hymn, you would have, like, a song that had 18 verses.
You have 5 seconds left.
18 verses. Now our worship songs have 4 words. In the whole song.
That's real.
So hymns.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying, and hymns are beautiful, and I love hymns. However, I think that as you look across society in so many different ways, we see progression in the arts, that art gets better, that technology improves, that there's just improvement in what people are able to do, and I think that that's true in worship music and music in general as well. You think about, yes, the musicality is a little simpler, but it's also much more engaging, it's more emotionally provocative, and a lot of words from hymns are utilized in modern worship
songs. That's because the words are better.
I think we've written all the songs that can be written at this point. And then also, you look at the ease of singing along. Yes, I think that repetition can be problematic. However, for somebody who's just learning the faith and figuring out their faith, the modern worship songs are easier to sing, they're catchier, we can sing along more easily, and I think that makes them more accessible. So that is the reason why. Mm.
This is why the boys are depressed and not getting better.
We don't have hymns.
Because we don't sing hymns. that is why.
All right, who won that one?
Judah got that one.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry, Brian.
Which also, hymns are absolutely better than modern worship songs.
I can understand.
I was arguing against my own beliefs there. So, all right, go ahead, Noah.
All right, last one. Sorry, I got to pull up my notes. Christmas music should start the day after Thanksgiving to New Year's, not before or after. Brian, you're going to be for. Judah, you're going to be against.
Yeah, very simple. We're not Costco here putting out our Halloween costumes in July or our Christmas decorations in September. there is a Christmas season. We are, first of all, people who are subject to a liturgical calendar, whether or not we follow it. And the liturgical calendar tells us that the Advent season starts right after Thanksgiving. So that is when we put away our turkey, we wake up from our tryptophan
coma. Who hurt you?
Tryptophan coma. And we turn on the Christmas music and we love it for those 30 some odd days until the new year, when it's no longer Christmas season and we get excited about the new year.
See,
in front
Noah,
of us.
This
there
is what happens.
There is a season, and it is a season to be enjoyed and relished, but that then that season ends. Okay.
This is what happens when the boys don't go to therapy. Right? Is that they grow up to be people who, you know, advocate for like the existence of the Grinch over Santa.
30 Listen, days of fun.
Christmas is about celebrating Christ. And I don't know about your life, but Christ is my savior. All year, in January and February and March. The issue is that some of y'all don't want to celebrate Jesus. Mm. This is what people do when they're like, making bad faith arguments.
That's ridiculous.
They just, they just turn it. They just, you don't love Jesus.
You don't believe your own words right now. I know you don't.
Okay, here's my real argument.
Walking around the Christmas tree is biblical.
Here's my real argument. My real argument is that a part of what happens during the Christmas season for a lot of people is that they become hopeful and excited and more joyful.
20 seconds.
And I just feel like if we start Christmas music a little bit earlier, like in July, that we might be able to combat some real depression, mental health, and unhappiness. And I think we should give it a try.
Reminds me of a scene from How I Met Your Mother where they're teasing Ted Mosby for like having weird reasons for breaking up with girls, and one was her obsession with Christmas music. It was August. The weather was far from frightful.
So, like, first of all, who won, Noah?
I feel like Brian won that one.
Boo. Hey-o.
So I'm sorry.
I will say, in like real life, I actually can't stand Christmas music.
No, that's so real.
I can't stand it.
I love it for 1 month a year, and I'm ready to see it go.
It's
by
probably
the end
one
of that
car
month.
Ride worth of music, and then I'm like, okay, I'm done.
All right.
Okay, I want to try something. I know we, and this may get cut. Lucian may cut this, but I want you to play. I'm gonna give you guys an argument, and I want you to jump in here. Okay. So the argument is that you should skip leg day or you should skip arm day. Noah, I want you to argue skipping leg day is better.
Okay.
Brian, I want you to argue skipping
like
arm day.
Like always skipping leg day?
Okay.
Okay.
And Brian, go.
Legs are the foundation of everything that you do. If you want to be a strong human being, if you want to be a good athlete, if you want to be able to function in life, you've got to have a good base of support. So obviously, a better workout regimen would include everything. But if you have to choose between having this big old upper body walking around, you know, that you're carrying around with a couple of twigs, or solid legs that can play sports, that can run, that can hike, that can lift things, you got to have the base there to be able to actually have functional strength.
Understandable. All right. Well, I have this from personal experience. I had a shoulder injury, so I couldn't hit upper body, so I can only hit legs. And I regret it profusely. I would have rather had a leg injury and got upper body because think about it. Everyone can only really see your upper body. You go to the beach, you're not taking your pants off. You're taking your shirt off. So like,
depends on the beach.
It
depends
on the beach.
That's valid.
You do,
no, exactly. Yeah. But so like, for the most part, you're showing your muscles are for show. I mean, that's why I went to the gym. I wanted to show my muscles.
Difference between 42 years old and how old are you, Noah?
So I'm 19.
Yeah, go on.
I feel like upper body is more impressive. Like people can be like, ooh, they have really big arms and really big chests, rather than, oh, you have really big legs. Like, oh, but you have a really small chest. Like,
like no woman has ever looked across the room and said, ooh, those
legs.
Calves.
Ooh. Unless they go to the gym, but that's so real.
All right. Okay.
Well, I kind of gave my hand away. Yeah, I think Noah won that. But I also feel like it's a better true argument.
Are you just trying to justify skipping leg day? Is that what's happening here?
Don't skip leg day.
All right. Well, hey, thanks everybody for joining us. Thanks, Noah, for being a part of the episode.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you next week on Engaging Culture. Bye-bye.